morning. Yeah, welcome to fabulous Las Vegas. You got to appreciate a city that gives itself a title by officially putting an adjective in its name. You know, I've established a guideline over the years that says that if you spend more than 3 nights in Las Vegas, New Orleans, or your in-laws, the chances of something bad happening increase substantially. That's why this conference is only 2.5 days, so you're welcome. We have a very Vegas-worthy conference lined up for you. Valuable content, opportunities to network, do a lot of business, hopefully even have a little fun. It's not too much fun. I don't know what it is about Las Vegas, but people just tend to overdo it just a little bit here. Ideas that would maybe be absurd about anywhere else just sometimes seem foggily plausible in Las Vegas. So if you're out this week and it's late and you're with your friends and one of them says, hey, do you think we could talk Wayne Newton into driving us up to Area 51? I bet he could get us in up there. That means time to go to bed. So please, let's be safe. Let's take care of each other this week. Let's especially help out our international guests. Everybody knows what it's like to be a stranger in a strange land, and this land is a little stranger than most, so let's just take care of each other and be safe. This year's conference is a little different because we get to do a little celebrating. First, we're celebrating the EPA's 2013 volume increase. Now, I'm serious. We should take a moment and actually celebrate this accomplishment. It was so critical, not because of the additional 280 million gallons this year, but because of the precedent that it sets, which clears the pathway for sustainable industry growth for the next 10 years. We also get to celebrate the extension of the tax credit, the 10th anniversary of the conference, and the 20th anniversary of NBB. So what I'd like to do this morning is talk to you a little about where we've been over the last 20 years, and then speak about the future and where we're headed. In thinking about what I wanted to say today, it occurred to me that the past and the future of the biodiesel industry can best be described in 3 distinct eras. These eras are distinct for the biodiesel industry, but also as standalone eras in history. The first 10 years is what I think of as biodiesel's childhood. The second 10-year era, roughly the past decade, is what I think of as biodiesel's teenage years. And like many teenagers, the industry was awkward, rebellious, very emotionally unstable during this period. And then finally, I'll talk about the next 10 years, which I believe is the era where biodiesel moves into early adulthood. Biodiesel will be in its 20s during this period, and like most people in their 20s, this era will provide a lot of exciting growth, development, and innovation as long as we stay dedicated and unified as an industry. So let's look at the first era of biodiesel's development, the era from about 1992 to about 2002, or biodiesel's childhood, if you will. This was an era in history that was bookended by war, but filled in between with the longest peacetime prosperity in modern memory. It started as the U.S. had just won the Cold War and the first Gulf War, and it ended when the menace of international terrorism hit our shores. The era had a new spirit of confidence. The stock market, real estate markets surged. The era experienced surprisingly mild levels of conflict and tragedy relative to other periods. Biodiesel was an experimental fuel during most of this time, as NBB conducted millions of dollars of engine and emission testing, quality specification development through the support of the soybean checkoff. And we laid regulatory and legislative groundwork through the support of the American Soybean Association. As childhoods go, it was mostly happy and well-adjusted, with the usual bumps and boo-boos along the way, but it had positive guidance and leadership. Take a look. Now, the next era for biodiesel was the last 10 years, about 2002 to about 2012. These are what I call biodiesel's teenage years. This was a very unstable time for biodiesel with very high highs and very low lows. Meanwhile, from the perspective of history, I could make the case that the first decade of the third millennium could be a strong candidate for the weirdest decade in modern history. It was a decade so full of catastrophic events that it brought infatuation with the end of the world out of the realm of the cult and directly into the mainstream. In an excellent book called The Last Myth, the authors insightfully dubbed this era the apocalyptic decade. The era was launched with the manufactured Y2K scare and ended with the manufactured Mayan calendar and fiscal cliff scares. The entire period was dominated by calamity, violence, and tragedy, all while simultaneously running in the background were the second and third longest-running wars in American history. The calamities of this last decade became so common that most of us don't really even think about or remember how weird it really got. So let's just list off a few of these things just as a reminder. The apocalyptic decade began on September 11, 2001, with the largest act of international terrorism in history. 1 week after 9/11 attack, anthrax letter bombs started showing up in D.C. and New York, and then the D.C. sniper attacks. The ending of the era saw the deadly terrorist attack on the consulate in Libya on September 11, 2012. We had the Indonesian tsunami that killed almost 500,000 people, and the Japanese earthquake, tsunami, and nuclear disaster. We had one of the deadliest earthquakes of all time in Haiti. Atrocities were coming out of Iraq, including televised beheadings in Abu Ghraib. We had some of the deadliest hurricanes in American history, including Katrina, Rita, Wilma, and Sandy. We had some of the worst flooding in 2011, followed by one of the worst droughts in 2012. We had outbreaks of swine flu, bird flu, West Nile. The Deepwater Horizon accident was the worst accidental spill in history. And crude oil prices spiked to inflation-adjusted all-time high, then went 40% higher, smothering the global economy. That isn't even mentioning the collapse of the banking industry, the collapse of the auto industry, the collapse of the stock market, and the collapse of Twinkies. Now, I don't even think the doomsday preppers saw Twinkie-mageddon coming. On the other hand, this era saw a surprising amount of human progress. While the previous era saw computer, cellular, and internet technologies lead an information revolution, the 2000s saw these three technologies combine to make smartphones, which began revolutionizing everything. Americans elected the first African-American president twice. The Red Sox finally broke the curse of the Bambino, beating the St. Louis Cardinals, no less. So congratulations, Red Sox fans, for overcoming that stubborn curse. Biofuels brought a renaissance to rural America and the agricultural sector. Where rural America was drying up and dying, it's now prospering like never before. This renaissance is having far-reaching implications for the stimulation of exciting plant science research, attracting some of America's brightest talents into all areas of agriculture. Precision agriculture is doing amazing things and has tremendous potential for humanity and the entire planet. I started with NBB in 1997, almost 16 years ago. It was becoming increasingly obvious back then that in order for a nascent industry to begin to participate in the highly volatile energy sector, it would take sound, effective energy policy. And when I became CEO a couple years later, ramping up our policy efforts became our top priority. In 2002, we had about a dozen or so commercial scale biodiesel producers and about 30 members of the National Biodiesel Board. By 2008, NBB's ranks had grown to over 400 member companies from virtually every state in the country of all sizes and business models, technologies, and feedstocks. Many of these companies came and went within this same era. As we pursued our federal energy policy, we had successes from EPACT to the bioenergy program to RFS1 to the tax credit to RFS2. Simultaneously, as the federal policy was evolving, we worked with stakeholders in virtually every state to enact supportive state legislation. With early successes in states like Minnesota and Illinois, we saw successful state policy expand to states all across the country. We also had to work to prevent negative legislation and regulation, For example, we spent millions of dollars on additional testing to convince the states of Texas and California not to outlaw biodiesel blends in Texlead and carb diesel, and to allow biodiesel to participate in the low-carbon fuel standard. All of these policy efforts were necessary to eliminate barriers and to stimulate growth. But the evolution of these policies was very difficult and certainly not smooth. They did stimulate growth, but they also created market uncertainty and other growing pains like fuel quality issues, sustainability questions, and most recently, RIN integrity challenges. Much like a teenager does a lot of learning and growing through car wrecks and breakups and fights and awkwardness, embarrassment, rebelliousness, devastating heartbreak to irrational youthful exuberance, biodiesel's teenage years and our path to achieve stable energy policy had all that drama and then some. Let's watch. So now I want to talk about the future and the next 10-year era as biodiesel moves into early adulthood. I truly believe that 2013 will mark the beginning of a new era for America, the world, as well as the biodiesel industry. A new Bakhtun, if you're Mayan. The apocalyptic decade is over, and we've come out of it and survived. 2012 was a fitting end to this era because, on the one hand, the industry was doubly hit with the lapse of the tax credit and the loss of RIN integrity. On the other hand, 2012 was a year of achievement in policy in other areas. Tomorrow's general session will focus on federal policy. We also saw our work with RIN integrity measures pay off. The EPA is here with us this week with two sessions tomorrow to talk about their new rulemaking on quality assurance plans and a session on the future of the RFS. The upside to all that struggle is that we as an industry are more seasoned and battle-tested. We've proven that we can overcome adversity and that we can put up a fierce fight and win. 2013 feels like a new era for the nation and the rest of the world as well. People are finally beginning to feel a little more optimistic. Confidence is growing. Economy is showing signs of improvement. The banking industry and auto industry and stock market have all rebounded. There's a domestic energy boom, and thanks to the RFS, biodiesel's poised to be a part of it. Horizontal drilling and hydraulic fracturing technologies opened up access to new sources of domestic petroleum. Now, this is a good thing for jobs, the trade balance, and the economy in the near term. But there are those who use this fact to argue against the need to develop our renewable energy resources. This line of argument is shockingly simplistic, and believe me, shockingly is the nicest word I could come up with. It asserts that if we just develop more of our own petroleum, we increase the supply, decrease the price, and free market forces will ensure that everyone gets cheap gasoline. This assertion assumes that crude oil is a regional commodity with regional pricing relationships and that petroleum is traded in an open and free market environment. But of course, both of those assumptions are absurd. Crude is a global commodity, and the price is set globally based not on worldwide supply and demand factors, but on political factors from the most politically unstable region in the world, and from manipulation from nationalized oil companies of totalitarian regimes, as well as an illegal cartel whose membership list reads like a who's who of state sponsors of terrorism. Even if America became 100% self-sufficient on petroleum, American fuel consumers and U.S. economy would still be subject to these flagrant market distortions. The evidence for this is that even though we are in the midst of the biggest domestic oil boom in decades, the price of crude and fuel has not dropped. It's remained steadily high. This has been a major factor to the restrained economic growth. The only way to change this cycle is to diversify our transportation fuel supply. Petroleum will always be a part of the mix, but the point is there has to be a mix if we want any kind of energy stability. Our goal is to make our transportation energy supply look more like our power generation energy supply. When you look at the materials we use to generate electricity, it's all domestic, highly diversified, regionally priced, and regionally abundant. We have coal, natural gas, nuclear, hydro, geothermal, wind, solar, biomass. These materials are not globally priced strategic commodities the way petroleum is. Nobody's going to war over these materials anytime soon. And because of this diversity, electricity is relatively stable and relatively affordable. So that is our role as an industry, to make the transportation fuel supply look more like the power generation supply. This is especially true for the heavy-duty side, where there aren't many viable technologies that can come close to diesel technologies to moving freight, which drives the economy. 2013 begins a new period for biodiesel because it represents a turning point for us as we look forward to the next 10-year era. 2013 will most likely be the most prosperous year to date for the industry. The RFS has gotten through its first couple of startup years. Now the bugs are getting worked out of the system. It's becoming more stable, more predictable, and more responsive to market signals. It's getting more refined as we go along. The EPA and the administration have demonstrated their commitment to the success of this program. And we as an industry have demonstrated our fierce commitment to face down every attack on it and win. And we'll continue to do so because those attacks will keep coming and they're about to get worse. We're determined to show that this program is good policy. 10 years from now, we will have proven that we were the ones on the right side of history rather than those who are fighting to keep this country in the bondage of dependence. I'm not talking about our many partners in the petroleum sector who we work with every day, many of whom we're glad to have here with us today. I'm talking about only a small segment of the petroleum industry who have conspired with other groups to publicly disparage biofuels with misrepresentations and specious arguments in major public relations campaigns to eliminate the RFS. For those people, we are putting you on notice right here today. We're making a commitment to see that in 10 years from now, when history looks back on this fight, that everyone will be held accountable for their truthfulness or their deceptions. We are going to stay committed to science, truth, and transparency, and we will make sure that misrepresentations are exposed. Thank you. Good science continues to expose the speculative theories and propaganda of those standing in the way of human progress. As the body of evidence on biodiesel continues to expand, the benefits of biodiesel continue to be confirmed. Biodiesel is the most sustainable fuel on the planet, and a decade from now, we will make sure that history will judge this fight by showing who were the champs and who were the chumps. NBB has just set a new 10-year vision, and we're proud to announce it here today. 8 years ago, at a time when the industry was still in the most awkward stages of its teenage years, the NBB set a bold 10-year goal of 5x15. We set out to be 5% of the diesel fuel supply by 2015. That was an aggressive goal at the time, but now we're on track to achieve that goal. In fact, it's possible we could even hit that goal this year, 2 years ahead of time. So last fall, industry leaders gathered to set a new 10-year goal. In a very deliberate way, they established the new goal of 10x22. That is 10% of the diesel fuel supply by 2022. This goal is intended to be a stretch goal, but yet attainable. There will need to be technological breakthroughs in areas such as feedstock development in order for this goal to be met. And we must be responsible in monitoring our progress toward this goal and making adjustments if necessary. But given the rate of technological increase and advancement in agronomic and the agronomic data that we've developed, we believe this goal is achievable. And speaking of breakthroughs in feedstock development, we have something else to announce publicly today. The NBB has been working with the Danforth Plant Science Center for the last 4 years on a project looking at oilseed breeding technology that could increase oil content in soybeans. As a result of these investments, researchers have developed technology that has demonstrated 2% and possibly higher increases in the oil content of beans. Preliminary data suggests these benefits occur without any loss of yield or negative impacts to protein quality. Imagine adding almost 500 million gallons of oil to the feedstock supply in the near term without negatively impacting protein. Add this to the known expected breakthroughs on yields, and you have some powerful shifts in feedstock supply. We also believe these technologies can eventually be utilized with other oil seeds as well. So you'll be hearing more about this breakthrough in the coming months. Meanwhile, NBB will continue to support the development of algae and other non-conventional feedstocks for the long term. The industry's just turned 20, and it feels like we have just moved into a new phase, out of the awkward teenage years and into early adulthood. We may only be moving on to junior college for now, but we're definitely more mature, more sophisticated, and turning the page to an exciting era for the industry. I'd like to share with you one of my favorite turning point stories that illustrates this idea. I'm a Missouri boy and a history lover, so not surprisingly, I'm a big fan of Lewis and Clark. I love the story of Lewis and Clark because it's adventure and history and science all rolled up into one. It has a colorful cast of characters. Sacagawea, for example, was a Shoshone chief's daughter who had been kidnapped by an enemy tribe at age 12 and later given to a French trapper to pay off a gambling debt. The first 2 years of the expedition were brutal. They paddled the entire length of the Missouri from St. Louis to the headwaters in Montana, upstream the whole way. It's fitting that the National Biodiesel Board headquarters is located in Jefferson City on the Lewis and Clark Trail, and specifically on Clark Avenue, no less, because we know a thing or two about paddling against the current. They had disunity in the ranks in the beginning, and they got to spend their first winter in the mild tropics of North Dakota. They were discovering new Indian tribes who wanted to kill them. They were discovering new species of animal, like grizzly bear, who tried to eat them. By the time they'd gotten to the Rocky Mountains, they were in desperate need of finding some friendly Indians to trade for horses and supplies, which they needed to get over the Rockies. They knew that if they got stuck on the east side of the mountains during winter, they would all die. Finally, they found some Indians, but they weren't sure if these were friendly Indians or if they wanted to kill them. So they brought Sacagawea to talk to the chief. When the chief and Sacagawea saw each other, huge smiles, they started hugging and crying. The chief was Sacagawea's brother, Camelweight. It was her family she had been kidnapped from 5 years earlier. So Camelweight gave them horses and supplies, and they were able to cross the mountains and ultimately finish the voyage. Now, this is why I tend to prefer nonfiction over fiction. If you tried to write that into a novel, you would never get away with it. But that really happened. It was a stroke of good fortune, to be sure, but don't forget, it was Lewis and Clark who knew they would need a Shoshone guide when they got to the Continental Divide. So it was foresight that made that good fortune possible. An incredible turning point without which American history might have been very different. I saw a bar sign one time that I liked so well that I had to get this picture. To those who make the maps, not follow them. I love that. That is the story of Lewis and Clark. But that's biodiesel's story, too. We didn't have a map to follow on how to build an advanced biofuel industry from the ground up. We've never had a map. We're making the map as we go, people. And there will be other advanced biofuels that benefit from our map. But for all the obstacles, I have to say that I think we've done pretty well so far. And here we are. This is our Camelweight moment. We still have mountains to climb. We still have a long way from home. But we have the experience, we have the strength, and we finally have the momentum. And I truly believe that our best days are ahead. Thank you.